Lenny had always enjoyed the aspect of traveling through computer systems that made him feel like a fearless explorer. He liked the idea of having computers throughout the world at his fingertips. The most exciting thing about playing around on the ARPANET military network hadn't been so much the information it contained. It was the act of roving itself. Lenny's hacking may have kept him cooped up for days at a time in the VPA office or in the Highway Host Motor Inn, but at the same time it broadened his world far beyond the San Fernando Valley. The ARPANET was the granddaddy of all computer networks. Started with United States military research funding in the late 1960s, the network had served as the technology testing ground for the commercial computer networks such as TIMNET and TELNET that were to follow. The ARPANET originally linked universities with corporate and military research facilities. By 1988, the ARPANET had largely been subsumed in a growing thicket of commercial, academic, scientific, government, and military networks known collectively as the Internet. The Internet joined individual networks together via computerized gateways so that it was possible to travel electronically almost anywhere in the industrialized world. With the advent of computer networks, the traditional sense of geographic space as it was known to explorers of earlier times was becoming obsolete. It had been replaced by a different notion, the idea of cyberspace. Traveling from a computer in suburban Los Angeles to a computer in Singapore was a matter of typing one command on a keyboard. It happened instantly. In fact, distance on the Internet was so transparent that a computer located in Southeast Asia would appear no different than a computer in the next building or in the next county. They would merely be different numbers on a computer host table, a listing of computers on a network. As it happened, Kevin and Lenny's favorite computer manufacturer was also a pioneer in computer networking. At Digital, networking really meant remote computing, the freedom to move work around the network from one computer to another. The company also tried to make it easy for an engineer in Massachusetts to work on a set of data in California. Networking among digital computers was built around simplicity, uniformity, and ease of use. In 1984, Digital built its own internal corporate network, the EasyNet. Eventually, the EasyNet would connect 34,000 digital computers in more than 25 nations, giving direct access to nearly two-thirds of the company's 120,000 employees. EasyNet has made Digital the world's best networked corporation. Engineers in Germany, Japan, and the United States share design work and rally support for project proposals. Employees also send messages directly to Digital President Ken Olson, so it wasn't surprising that EasyNet became a favorite playground for Kevin and Lenny. Since it was strictly a VMS system as opposed to the Unix-heavy Internet, EasyNet spoke their language, and for two young network explorers with an eye toward procuring Digital's proprietary software, EasyNet was the perfect transportation medium. Once they were on one computer in the network, they could connect to any other. When Kevin and Lenny penetrated EasyNet, Lenny was as excited as he had ever been. Later, Lenny would say that his breaking into computers with Kevin was like we were boldly going where no hackers had gone before. But to Kevin, it was just a task, like coming to work every day, just to get the job done. While Lenny seemed content to scamper from one computer on the EasyNet to another like a puppy, sniffing at each new one, Kevin considered their computer system cracking a serious endeavor with a series of discrete goals. In fact, for as long as Lenny could remember, Kevin had always approached his illicit computing as a serious project. When he sought revenge on someone, it was as if he were taking on an assignment from some invisible employer. Once an assignment was complete, he reported back to Lenny or Roscoe with news of his triumph. As early as 1981, Kevin would call Roscoe to report the results of a frontal assault on the telephone service of someone he was out to harass. Kevin's project for 1988 was downloading Digital's VMS source code. It wasn't so that he could make pirate copies and sell them. Rather, it was both the challenge of the hack itself and his intellectual curiosity about such a complex and advanced system. Kevin's heavy phone use had just gotten him fired from a small firm near Thousand Oaks that made electronic testing equipment. He was sleeping until at least 11 every morning and would usually put in his first call to Lenny around noon. Around 3 in the afternoon, Kevin would instruct him to get started with a particular task. Then, at about 7 on the days they didn't have class at Pierce, Kevin would show up at VPA, and after dinner, they would return for a night of network exploring. As the night wore on, Kevin's pocket pager sounded every hour. It was Bonnie, wondering where her husband was. He lied and said he was taking evening class at UCLA. Kevin's lack of accountability to his wife didn't seem to matter to him. One of the first orders of business on these evenings was to go into a large telephone wiring closet on the ground floor of the building and connect VPA's modem line to another tenant's phone. To someone checking toll records, it then seemed that calls were coming from another business. By now, Kevin had refined this technique, prompted in part by his increasing knowledge of how the police and telephone security forces worked, and by a growing paranoia. He regularly checked to make certain there were no dialed number recorders on the line he was using, and to be extra safe, Kevin and Lenny looked for an untraceable way to make long-distance calls. Like many other hackers and phone freaks, they frequently used illegal MCI calling card numbers. Most freaks would scan for them. That is, they would program their computers to have their modems keep dialing a local MCI port and enter different codes until a successful code was found. Purloined codes were traded on electronic bulletin boards or code lines, toll-free voicemail numbers that had been discovered by hackers and modified to dispense pirated calling card numbers. But Kevin, in his inimitable way, had perfected a method for obtaining telephone credit card numbers with great efficiency. He later told the FBI that he had obtained the password for the network security count on MCI's electronic mail system from an electronic bulletin board. But Lenny knew that Kevin had talked someone out of the password, using his excellent social engineering skills. Once logged on to the MCI network security account, Kevin and Lenny were privy to confidential information about new accounts, stolen accounts, and accounts that were in a state of limbo until MCI actually discontinued them. They could also read electronic messages concerning security breaches. It was a fertile field from which to harvest account numbers, as well as an early warning system to subvert the security types. Kevin guarded the MCI network security account from Lenny as if he were in possession of the Hope Diamond. "This is something I could make money with," he would tell him. Slipping into Digital's EasyNet was a little like discovering the motherlode. All of the company's private discussions were carried out over the worldwide network. Using relatively standard tricks, Kevin and Lenny collected passwords. For instance, when a machine is first set up, there are a few pre-established accounts with preset passwords for the convenience of Digital's field service people. Each such password gives access to that account's electronic mail. Once Kevin and Lenny had found these passwords, they used Kevin's gift for intuiting how organizations functioned and who was important in an organization. An untrained but instinctively expert social scientist, Kevin could look at patterns of communication in stored electronic mail and figured out who had power and who had valuable information. In that way, they found the mail that was worthy of their attention. Andy Goldstein's mail was by far the most informative. Goldstein was regarded by many as the most brilliant technical expert in the VMS engineering ranks. He was also a VMS security expert. As a result, most messages about VMS security problems eventually ended up in Goldstein's mailbox. One of his correspondents was Neil Clift, a researcher at Leeds University in England. From what Lenny and Kevin could tell, VMS security was a hobby of Clift's. He seemed to spend hours plumbing the depths of operating system arcana in search of security flaws. Clift was a prolific electronic correspondent. Most of his messages to Goldstein concerned problems with VMS security, and every time he described a new flaw to Goldstein, Kevin and Lenny drank in every word. It was while snooping through Andy Goldstein's electronic mail that Kevin and Lenny found the infamous Chaos Computer Club login-out patch. From what Kevin and Lenny could decipher from the mail to Goldstein, it seemed that someone in Europe had broken into a European institution using the Chaos patch. The victimized company had made a copy of its entire system and sent it to Digital to analyze. Goldstein, it appeared, had analyzed the program, extracted the portion containing the rogue code, and reverse-engineered what the Chaos Club had inserted. After stealing Goldstein's analysis from his mailbox, Lenny and Kevin puzzled for days over the unexpected prize that had landed in their hands. From what they could tell, someone from Chaos had changed Login-Out, the program for logging in and out of the computer. Chaos had modified or patched the program so that each time a password was entered, a copy of the password was sent to a spot in a remote corner of the system, where it sat unnoticed until someone came to retrieve it. Lenny and Kevin couldn't believe their luck. A program to steal any VMS password, courtesy of Digital. Not only was the login-out patch small and smooth, but it had an added feature that made the user's presence difficult for the system to detect. To further confound Digital's computer security experts, the login-out patch had been written in such a way that it successfully eluded ordinary techniques to detect software that has been tampered with. Thus, no standard computer security alarms were set off by the program when the patch modified the computer's operating system. A system operator would never realize something was amiss. In fact, the patch was written so well that Digital officials had little notion that their machines had been so thoroughly compromised. Kevin and Lenny were delighted by this bit of serendipitous international cooperation. More than that, they were in awe of the Chaos Club for its ingenious hack. They had been calling themselves the best, but now that they had seen this, they amended their epithet to the best in the West. So USC's Mark Brown had been right after all. However, it wasn't the work of the Chaos Club itself he was seeing, but that of a pair of the club's admirers who had discovered and were using one of the club's cleverest hacks. The Chaos Club's famous hack into NASA's Worldwide Span computer network in the summer of 1987 had been a public relations calamity, both for NASA and for Digital, whose computers were the foundation of the Span network. For months, members of the Chaos Club had foraged through hundreds of computers on Span by exploiting an embarrassingly obvious hole in VMS. The cocky group of young computer anarchists had first broken into the CERN physics laboratory in Switzerland, then electronically hopped over the Atlantic to Fermilab in Illinois, and continued on to hundreds of computers on Span. When the incident first surfaced after Chaos held a press conference to announce its accomplishments, it revived some concerns that were first expressed following the 1983 release of the movie War Games. The film, which depicted a teenager who played havoc with a North American Air Defense Command computer, roused widespread speculation that bright kids could somehow compromise U.S. national security. In what seemed to be a similar situation, the infiltration of Span by Chaos implied to the public that Span was a sensitive military network. This proved not to be the case. Nevertheless, it was more than an embarrassing incident for NASA and for Digital. The company suffered a corporate black eye. Nothing like this had ever happened to computers made by International Business Machines, Digital's principal competitor. Digital could ill afford bad publicity. The company was under fierce competitive pressure, moving thousands of employees from assembly lines and corporate offices into the sales force in an effort to slash costs and boost sales. For nearly a decade, Digital's strength had been its sturdy, steady seller, the VAX, a potent force against IBM. But by 1988, the pace of technology was forcing Digital to seek out new markets while continuing to satisfy its traditional customers. Digital was locked into a race, scrambling to bring out new products and rebuild the VAX line. The computer industry was no longer growing exponentially, particularly in the minicomputer business that Digital had long dominated. Instead, the markets for personal computers and workstations were still expanding, but the company had stumbled badly in the PC business. To get back on course, Digital was going to have to go after a more commercial market than it had served in the past. Financial institutions were a new major target, and they would hardly tolerate potential flaws in the security of the machines they were buying. So the company remained as quiet as possible about the NASA incident. It patched the loopholes and tried to tighten security. As it turned out, its efforts were less than successful. The login-out patch was written so cleanly that Lenny and Kevin had to modify it only slightly to install it on the newer version of VMS used in the United States. Once they had done that, they were ready to insert their new Trojan horse. In the ensuing months, it was to become their most valuable electronic crowbar. Kevin and Lenny dubbed it their super-duper password scooper.